Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with General Wesley Clark, who is the former Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, the head of NATO forces. Prior to that, he served as the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Southern Command and Director of Strategic Plans and Policy for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He is a graduate of the United States Military Academy at West Point. He's also a Rhodes Scholar, and General Clark is now an investment banker, and he's working on some new technology for electric motors for cars, motorcycles, and bicycles. So, and of course, there's a lot of speculation about whether or not General Clark will run for president as a Democrat. We'll be talking to General Clark in a moment. We'll also go to London and speak with Tariq Ali, who has a new book, Bush in Babylon, The Colonization of Iraq. And, of course, Tariq Ali's previous book, The Clash of Fundamentalism, is a very important book, particularly in light of what is happening in Iraq. And, of course, we'll be talking to Tariq Ali about the possibility of a clash, not in terms of his original clash of fundamentalism between Christians, Jews, and Muslims, but in this case, an intra-Muslim clash between Shia and Sunni that seems to be a possibility in Iraq. And of course, most of the oil-rich part of Iraq and the Gulf has sits upon 60% of the West's oil supply. And this, of course, is an area where the predominantly Shia live. So we'll be talking about that. And at the end of the program, or towards the end of the program, we'll be talking with two specialists on Korea. Just a few days ago in Tokyo, former President Jimmy Carter, who defused a possible war between the United States and North Korea back in 1994, spoke in Tokyo the other day, describing the situation between North Korea and the United States as the world's greatest threat. And in a couple of days' time, on Tuesday, the North Koreans will be celebrating the 55th anniversary of the foundation of their state. And we will, there's some speculation that the North Koreans may celebrate their 55th anniversary by exploding a nuclear device. So we'll be talking to two specialists on North Korea, Dr. Martin Hart Landsberg and Dr. Sunhae Sa, who is here in Los Angeles. Dr. Sunhae Sa is a assistant professor at Scripps College, Claremont. She's an organizer with a Korean group, translation of which means stepping stones, and she has relatives in both North and South Korea. And Professor Martin Hart Landsberg is a author of Korea Division Reunification and U.S. Foreign Policy. He's a professor of economics and the director of the Political Economy Program at Lewis and Clark College. And he's also a researcher at the Institute for Social Studies at Gwangsang National University in South Korea. I'm speaking with General Wesley Clark, the former Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, head of NATO forces, and now an investment banker and working on some venture capital operations, including the possibility of an electric drive for cars, motorcycles, and bicycles, among other things. But let me begin with 9/11, since on Thursday it'll be the second anniversary of 9/11. General Clark, it seems that immediately that 9/11 happened, both at the Pentagon, at the White House, there was an assumption that Iraq was behind it. And subsequently, when the anthrax was released, there was also an immediate assumption that Iraq was behind that. And CBS News has reported on this, and I think it's fairly well understood that was the initial response, both at the Pentagon and the White House and the National Security Council, was to point the finger at Iraq. Why this reflexive assumption that Saddam Hussein is behind everything, in a sense, and I assume it means that if we get him, all our problems are over?
Well, I think there was a long-standing vilification of Saddam Hussein. Not that he didn't deserve it, but he became the hobby horse of the security lobby in the late 1990s, and it was both because of his defiance of the United Nations and also because there was a certain frustration inside the administration at the time, the Democratic administration, in dealing with the problem. And in a group called the Project for a New American Century formed up and provided the nucleus of an idea that Saddam Hussein had to be taken out by force. They lobbied the president to do this. They obviously worked with other members of Congress, and they created a groundswell of determination to pin many of the problems in the Middle East on Saddam Hussein. And subsequently, after 9/11, of course, that's what happened. And I think that there was a widespread appreciation in the American public for Saddam Hussein, his penchant for mischief, and even yesterday there was a Washington Post front-page story that said that some 70% of the American public still believe that Saddam Hussein somehow was connected to 9/11, despite the absence of any evidence to show that.
And what do you think? You think it's just I think you've characterized the so-called neocons, but there seems to almost be a kind of personal dimension to this, given the unfinished business of President 41, and this, and President himself said at one point, he tried to kill my dad. I'm just trying to get a handle on this because, as you recall, in the run-up to this war, the administration never really gave a coherent and consistent reason for this war. It changed from the human rights arguments about him being a murderer and a danger. Then there's a weapons of mass destruction and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just speculating because essentially I don't think the public were ever really given a strong case.
Well, I think that there were many reasons advanced. The problem was that there was no single compelling reason. And this was the weakness of the administration's case. It was based on old evidence and fear and intuition. And they attempted to create the impression that there was both a nuclear threat building in Iraq and that there was a strong potential that either he had or would be giving assistance to Al-Qaeda. Neither of those two contentions has actually been substantiated still to this day. So I think the case remains weak, but much of the language of the administration over the last 2 years was canted to imply these connections and these threats, even though they were never substantiated. I went back and looked at language of the administration, of the president, the vice president, secretary of defense, many others, and when it's looked at, you can see the implications that are there, even though the specific hard evidence is lacking. The question is whether you can make effective foreign policy, especially in the use of force and the attack on another state, on the basis of implications and intuitions, as opposed to more substantive evidence.
Well, all the wars that the United States have fought, they're somewhat, at least in since World War II, it's obviously easy to get in and harder to get out. But whether you agree with the reasons or not, at least they were argued and stated. I think probably the only other example would be perhaps Grenada, in terms of the at least the stated reason being to rescue medical students. But this
right. This
one here, if I was over there in uniform, I'd be wondering why I was sent in harm's way. And I understand from talking to people in the military and relatives of people in the military, there is a sense that maybe some of these soldiers over there feel they've been had.
I think there's a lot of frustration on the part of the soldiers, in part because the end state wasn't well-defined and the tasks following the conclusion of the operation weren't well-defined. And so I think there was an anticipation on the part of many of the troops that they'd go over there, they'd knock the army apart, the people would rise up, welcome them, it would be like the liberation of France in 1944, and they'd pack up and come home. And, of course, it's been exactly the opposite. It's been a very tough go. And so I think the troops are frustrated. And I think that frustration then starts and works backwards into undercutting the rationale for the mission and the commitment that the troops at the time so strongly felt in most of the public pronouncements. I remember them saying our cause is just, we're going in to remove a threat to the United States and so forth. It's just that it hasn't subsequently turned out that way.
And in your book, Waging Modern Warfare, you deal with the issue. I mean, obviously, there's been an enormous shift since the end of the Cold War from our preoccupation throughout the Cold War with national security and national threats and this sudden emergence of transnational and subnational threats.
Right.
And it seems that the Pentagon still is like a giant supertanker trying to slowly turn. We're still procuring stuff for the Cold War, fighter jets, submarines, etc. And this these transnational and subnational threats have required the Pentagon to be both the military and the Peace Corps. And it seems that in the build-up to this war, I understand from talking to some of the Iraqis involved in the governing council, that they were working with the State Department, and they were talking and planning for a post-war scenario, but the minute the Pentagon took over, that all got lost in the shuffle. So why are we putting all of this burden on the soldiers? I mean, you can't expect a soldier to fight a war and then immediately turn around and make a country.
Ian, you're exactly right. And what has happened over the last 10 years, and then especially accentuated in this administration, is that the Pentagon is the go-to agency. It's the agency with funding, leadership, assets, the transportation, communications, the can-do attitude, to attempt to make a difference, and trying to build up another agency is extraordinarily difficult. It runs across congressional committee and funding priorities, budget restrictions, many other factors. And what's happened is that the execution of U.S. foreign policy has become—it's moved lopsided to rely on the Pentagon, even in areas in which it's clear that other efforts should be undertaken.
But the extraordinary thing about this, General Clark, is that before this war, I interviewed, for example, Yusuf Ibrahim, a 25-year veteran of the New York Times in the Middle East, Bob Baer, the former CIA operative in Iraq. And he said, for example, Baer said every one of his contacts in the neighborhood predicted exactly this. And on this program, months before this war began, Yusuf Ibrahim and others, Graham Fuller and others, were saying exactly what was going to happen. That of course the United States were going to beat this country, and it'd be a quick war followed by a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. So at least the scenarios were out there for what's happening now.
I think there's no doubt about it, and most of the experts I talked to felt the same way. But
explain the disconnect, Pentagon, though.
Well, when I went through the Pentagon, I found that the civilian leadership just didn't want to face the reality. They were determined that they were going to use 9/11 as the opportunity to rouse public opinion to support knocking off Saddam Hussein. And as we know from many subsequent articles, there were a variety of reasons proposed for this, none of which alone was compelling, and that it wasn't an action which was directed specifically against al-Qaeda. It was a kind of a preventive war, the start of an operation to get U.S. troops on the ground and some visionary aim to somehow reshape the Middle East by force.
Well, it does seem that we're heading towards a situation where I mean, you could almost make the case that perhaps we've even failed already and that we're sort of whistling past the graveyard here, because the dynamic is so destructive. If you have the soldiers hunkered down behind barbed wire, unable to go out and work with the Iraqi people because of security concerns, you cannot rebuild the nation if you can't work with the Iraqis. They can't do it without, and there's only 1,000 civilian advisors. So I'm just wondering how we're going to reverse this dynamic, because whatever you think of President Bush and his reasons for getting in there, the bottom line is, one may want President Bush to fail or the neocons to be purged, but you don't want America to fail.
You're exactly right, Ian, and you're asking a fundamental question, because it's very difficult to see how this can turn out. Now, the fact of the matter is that the American troops on the ground are doing an incredible good job in promoting reconstruction, helping schools reopen, trying to assist the Iraqi people, and as everybody has said, they have the support of 90% of the population, which means that there are probably a couple of million Iraqis who don't want them there. And those are tough odds for our forces in the region. And somehow, one can only hope that the creation of the Iraqi authority, a rapid movement toward a political development process of elections at the local, regional, national level, turning over authorities to the Iraqis, providing funding, interim funding to them, helping them reconstruct, creating Iraqi civilian security institutions like police, plus some Iraqi armed forces, that all of this will undercut the appeal of these extremist elements, and that the Iraqis themselves will increasingly cooperate with the U.S. forces. But we've got to draw our forces down there, because the simple truth is we don't have enough forces to sustain the level of commitment that we're currently carrying in Iraq indefinitely. So this move to the U.N. is vital. We've got to get a little relief in there from some other countries if we're going to have any chance at all of success, and we must succeed.
You were opposed to this war before. You went on the record with, and just briefly, what is your counter scenario of what we should have done?
Well, I was concerned from the outset that although Saddam probably had weapons of mass destruction, and I still believe that he probably did, at that time, I couldn't see the imminence of the threat or the lack of any alternatives which would have necessitated the invasion. I would have prioritized the problems in the war on terror differently. I would have worked to contain Iraq for another year or two. I would have used NATO, brought the problem to NATO, forced NATO collectively, the French, the Germans, the Brits, and the others, to get on board with us to assist us in pressuring Iraq. What would have been so wrong in putting 10,000 inspectors in, keeping 40,000 troops stationed in Kuwait, and flooding the country with human rights workers, and other reporting agencies, at the same time keeping the priority of the military intelligence effort directed directly against al-Qaeda? That would have been my preferred solution. Then turning back to Iraq in 2004, 2005, 2006, or whatever, when you might have had a much different situation, and you would have separated the problem of Iraq from the problem of al-Qaeda.
Well, of course, the successful prosecution of Kosovo, the result of having that particular tyrant, who I think killed something like a quarter of a million, which at least was responsible, he's before The Hague. It seems that since the end of the Cold War, all of the wars that the United States has fought, beginning with the first one in Panama, was essentially sending an army down to arrest one person. And there seems to be a common thread in this post-Cold War environment with the subnational and transnational threats transcending. Why can't we come up with a better mechanism? For example, with Saddam going back to Gulf War I, what we've done is punish the Iraqi people through sanctions. He and his family got rich. So there's something dysfunctional about our approach to these new threats, in the sense that we end up punishing the victims of tyrants and we have a hard time getting the tyrants. So is there another mechanism, the International Court of Justice, or some way to arrest and isolate these tyrants, and Africa is awash with them, that hide behind sovereignty?
I believe there are other ways. It takes a lot of policy coordination to reach it, but essentially it's a combination of using international law and engaging rather than isolating these regimes. We should be encouraging Citibank and financial institutions, Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and the rest of them, to go in there and make loans to these companies in these countries and invest. And then, as we discovered in Eastern Europe, when you draw these economies that were closed into closer relationship with the West, it undercuts the ability of the authoritarian regime to maintain control. And so we've taken precisely the opposite approach to Iran, to Iraq, to Syria, and others. We're punishing them by isolating them. And in effect, we're allowing the leaders to enrich themselves, impoverishing the people, and giving them the standoff they need from the ideas and values and instruments of economic and political and social development, which are our greatest weapons. The military is a use of last resort, should be used as a last resort. Our ideas and our institutions are much more powerful. If we'd worried about the Soviet threat and gone after Eastern Europe the way we've gone after Iraq, God knows what would have happened. Instead, now we have democracies thriving in Eastern Europe and economic development in this part of the world wanting to join the European Union. Surely there's another way.
General Clark, obviously you're not going to announce whether you're running for president or not on my radio show. However, there is some talk about it. But at the very least, it seems to me that you'd be doing this nation a service if you can generate the debate that we should have had before we went into Iraq and that we should have had after 9/11. It seems to me that the country's been impoverished intellectually. And if, as you mentioned earlier in the interview, you say that's what, 60% of the people in this country think that somehow that Saddam was behind 9/11?
According to this poll, some 69%, well, 70% is the headline, believe that Saddam was somehow connected to 9/11. And it just isn't so on the basis of any of the evidence that's been established through 2 years of intensive investigation.
So what is there a chance that you can help contribute to towards this kind of national awakening? Because if we're really digging a hole for ourselves in Iraq, and that there's no, you know, you can't just bug out, obviously, but on the other hand, you know, you can't fail, but on the other hand, maybe we're already failed. So I think it seems to me that we're at a very critical time in this country.
I think we are, and I'm certainly going to be doing my best to add to the dialogue and help us generate the debate that's necessary in a democracy.
And if you were to run, what would you say to the anti-war constituency in this country who opposed this war and who may not be able to relate to a general?
Well, first of all, I think they'd be very comfortable with my views. And secondly, I think it's time in American history for all of us to move on and look at the world we live in. So I respect people of all political persuasions. I've got a lot of friends in the Republican Party, and I've got a lot of friends among the peace movement. And I think it's a matter of personal relationships and respect for the opinions of others. And I hope they will look at what I've said and judge it accordingly.
Well, General Clark, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles and for the stance you've taken on the war. And as I say, I hope there is a broader national debate, because as you probably are as undoubtedly aware, that with the one branch of one party controlling three branches of government, you don't have the subpoena power. And back in the days when Clinton was in the White House, the Republicans were able to use subpoena power to torment him with endless hearings. But we can't even have hearings about it. I mean, wouldn't you agree that given what's going on, there should be congressional hearings about 9/11?
I certainly agree that there need to be some public hearings, that commission of inquiry into 9/11 needs to move ahead at a rapid speed. It is not moving very quickly, I'm told. And I think there are many other elements of the policy that are worthy of some public discussion and debate. It's one of the things that I found most frustrating is since the events of 9/11, much of this debate has been choked off by fear of being unpatriotic or simply by people who have assumed that the president knew more than everybody else. He shouldn't have to reveal it, and therefore we shouldn't question. But, you know, American government doesn't work that way. We operate on the basis of checks and balances. And I think that's more vital at a time of national emergency when we're under threat at home and abroad, even than it's been before. So I hope we will see that debate energized.
I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with General Wesley Clark, the former Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, head of NATO forces, and a possible candidate, a Democratic Party candidate for President of the United States. I'm now speaking with Tariq Ali, who is the author of The Clash of Fundamentalism, and he's the author of a new book that's coming out soon, Bush in Babylon, The Colonization of Iraq. And in terms of The Clash of Fundamentalisms, it seems that right now, Tariq Ali, in Iraq, there's a possibility of a clash between the Shia and the Sunni, and of course the bombing of an extremely holy shrine to the leading kind of prophet of the Shiism is had to be a traumatic effect event for the faithful. There's speculation that it was Wahhabis, Saudis. There were two Saudis arrested. Do you think this thing could spin into, not only are the American boys and girls there being targets for all kinds of shadowy forces, they may be caught on top of that in a civil war?
Well, the information on who bombed Najaf is so sketchy at the moment that we have nothing to go by. The Iranian government, which attacked the bombing very severely, I mean, unless I misread them, you know, they were sort of implying that it could have been orchestrated by the United States. I personally don't believe that, because the United States is already in a big mess, and they would have to be crazy to support that sort of stuff, and I don't think they did. But then the question remains, who carried it out? Whoever did it, in terms of mobilizing the overwhelming majority of the Shia population in southern Iraq, has been very effective, because it's mobilized them not so much against the Sunnis, because there have been lots of conciliatory meetings between Sunni and Shia clerics. The Sunni hierarchy in Iraq has denounced the bombing. Even the remnants of the Saddam party has denounced the bombing. Whoever carried out the bombing has effectively turned the Shia organizations against the occupation, because they link it to the chaos in the country, which is the direct result of the invasion and occupation of Iraq. So whether or not there'll be a civil war is an open question. What is without any doubt that we now have a low-intensity guerrilla warfare going on, like the early years of Vietnam, and we have a growing resistance organization which numbers about 40 different groups. They're not at all shadowy, by the way. They include, obviously, elements in the Ba'ath Party, but they include nationalists, they include Sunnis, they include Shias, and I'm told that they are having meetings and recruiting people at a very rapid rate.
Well, the one thing that you mentioned there, Tariq Ali, is that the information that the people would are believing that the Americans were behind this bombing, that leads to this extraordinary situation. You know, since there was apparently no peace plan there, there was only a war plan. The United States doesn't even have any information dissemination operation to counter these wild rumors. Apparently, the firebrand Shia cleric starter gets up there every Friday and says, the reason you don't have electricity is the Americans are giving it to the Israelis. think that they'd be able to counter that kind of insanity.
It is a totally confused and chaotic situation. And you know what is totally staggering? That people like me, who don't live there, but who have enough information from that part of the world, warned them before the war that if you decide to occupy Iraq, it is not going to be like Kosovo or the Balkans. It is going to be a bloody affair, and there will be a resistance. The population of Iraq does not want you to go in, however much they might despise Saddam Hussein. But the neocons, you know, Wolfowitz and Cheney and this whole gang, were so besotted with the Iraqi collaborators they've had on their payroll that they just refused to listen to anything else. And they were determined to go and take this country without any preparation whatsoever. I mean, you know, you go into a big Arab country and you destroy the state, and then there's chaos. You have nothing to put in its place. And this is what they are now discovering. And it was very interesting that after the big blackouts in New York of a few weeks ago, there were articles in the New York Times and other papers saying, we've just been through this, you know, for a few hours. Just think of what the Iraqis have to go through.
Well, obviously, there are lots of people that warned about this. In fact, on my radio program, well before it, we had several discussions about this scenario and predicting it absolutely as a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. Now, I'm so pessimistic about what's happening there that I think that we've already failed, and that we're just whistling past the graveyard now, and that the only, I think that even the Bushies may have figured this out, that they need the UN just to put a face on it and get the hell out. I mean, is there any way that they can turn it around, do you think?
I think it's been seen now in Iraq and in the region as a total disaster for the United States. Obviously, they have the military strength to stay in there, but there will be casualties. And all you need is one of these days or weeks or months for someone to try and really take out the barracks, I know they're very heavily guarded, and try and take 200-300 soldiers at one go, occupying the soldiers. Well, I mean, there'll be absolute mayhem in the American political scene if that happens. And people then who've, you know, been relatively quiet will get very angry. I mean, one reason for, you know, Wesley Clark saying what he is, the Democrats suddenly discovering they've got a tongue.
By the way, to be fair to Wesley Clark, though, he came out against the war before it.
I agree with you, but most Democrats didn't.
They voted for the damn thing.
They voted for this wretched war, and in Britain, a very similar operation. One reason now everyone's angry is because there's a resistance, which they just could not foresee, but which many of us warned them about was bound to happen.
By the way, Tariq Ali, have you read that piece from the former environment minister?
I have. Michael Meacher. He's a member of the Blair cabinet.
Right.
And he's come out very hard suddenly and attacked all this, which I'm glad he's done it, but he should have done it months ago and before the war.
He calls it a bogus war, though. He's not mincing his words. You know.
He's not mincing his words. He's made the toughest statement on the war from a member of the, or a former member of the Blair government. It's a very tough statement, much tougher than anything any other minister has said. And it's having an impact. And it shows how angry people are here, that they were misled with all these lies about weapons of mass destruction. I mean, you know, I sometimes run into perfectly intelligent people. And they say, oh, but you know, Tariq, We really believed the Prime Minister when he said that Saddam could attack Britain within 45 minutes. He had rockets which could reach us. And so these are the people now who are really angry with Blair because he succeeded in misleading them. And
well, it looks like he misled himself, though, didn't he?
I don't think so.
What do you think? Give me a sense of what happened there, because it's a total mystery why an intelligent man like that could have jumped onto the bandwagon so wholeheartedly with George W.
Well, I think that's the decision Blair took, that he was going to back this war once Bush had asked him to. There's no way he could say no. And then they went and actively began to try and discover the reasons why they were going to war. There were big rifts and splits inside the British intelligence organizations. I mean, a former very senior officer, a former national security advisor to Blair, and a former head of the Joint Intelligence Committee, Sir Roderick Braithwaite, came out. I mean, after the war, before the war, he'd done it in private. After the war, he came out and said, look at the chaos there is in Iraq. This could actually increase terrorism in the West even more. And then referring to Blair with sort of undisguised anger, he said, and I quote, fishmongers sell fish, warmongers sell war. And I think our prime minister oversold his wares. Now, For the head of an intelligence outfit to say this shows you the deep divisions that existed inside the British establishment on this war. Blair overrode them. And this is one reason why we have this inquiry going on and people want to get to the truth.
Tariq Ali, and again, I want to remind the audience that Tariq Ali's new book, Bush in Babylon, The Colonization of Iraq, will be coming out, I think, in a month?
Yeah, in a few weeks.
In a few weeks, yeah. Here in the United States. His previous book, of course, was Clash of Fundamentalisms. And let's just turn to al-Qaeda, the somewhat orphaned.
Yeah.
It's just like, it never happened, 9-11, or somehow that Saddam was responsible for 9-11. I mean, we're coming up on the second anniversary of 9-11. We have this bizarre situation where neither Mullah Omar or Osama bin Laden have been captured, although who knows whether bin Laden's really alive. Ironically, it seems that the President Bush intervening in Iraq, he's actually created his own nemesis. He's put together al-Qaeda and Saddam in a way that they never were before the war. He's also perhaps proliferated the weapons of mass destruction, since the people with the knowledge, which is really all that counts in bio and chemical, are on the black market. And there's no question that volunteers, jihadis, are pouring into Iraq. So what's your sense of where this is heading? Because I know in England in a few days' time, that I think it's that mosque in Brixton, is it, where they're celebrating the Magnificent 19?
Yeah, I think it's in Finsbury Park.
Finsbury Park. Oh, it's the Finsbury Park mosque, the one that have you ever interviewed that former Afghan imam without hands and with one eye?
To tell you the truth, I try and keep clear of these people. I mean, they're not very friendly towards me, since they know I'm a ferocious opponent of religious fundamentalism. So yeah. I tend to keep clear of them. I sometimes encounter them by accident, and we both turn the other way. But the situation with al-Qaeda is weird. You know, again here, some of us warned. I remember debating Charles Krauthammer soon after 9/11 on Canadian television. And I said, the war you're waging in Afghanistan is basically a war of revenge. And he said, I agree. So what? I said, so this, that the key question is, how do you stop the flow of young kids to these organizations? That's the question you have to ask. And unless you ask it and attempt to solve it, this will carry on. And I, at that point, after 9/11, I said the two key issues in the Arab world are Palestine, Israel, and the continuing sanctions against Iraq. On both those questions, the Bush regime has made exactly the wrong decisions by giving uncritical backing to Ariel Sharon, who's, you know, every single day we hear news of Palestinian kids being killed, buildings being destroyed, women being killed, random bombings targeting all sorts of people. So this is still going on. It doesn't get much time, if any, on the networks in the United States, but it's seen endlessly in the Arab world.
And in Europe, too, I believe.
And in Europe, too, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then instead of sorting out Iraq in terms of ending sanctions to give people the confidence to make their own decisions, change their own leaders, the United States goes and invades a sovereign Arab country and occupies it, and then thinks that this will be popular, and then goes in a sort of, you know, cowboy-like fashion and bumps off the two sons and one grandson of the deposed leader.
But guess what, Tariq Ali? It hasn't made a damn bit of difference.
It hasn't made any difference at all. Right. No difference at all. In fact, everything the United States has done, as Sir Roderick Braithwaite said, is actually increasing the attraction of terrorism. It's an awful thing to say, but that's the reality.
Well, of course, but the real reality, I think, for the Bush administration, I think in many ways they're a public relations operation pretending to be a government. I mean, they have gone up in the polls. They're starting to slip. But as long as they hold on and of course, war, if you go to war in this country, you win over most of the people.
Mm.
It seems to me that that has always been the very cynical calculus here.
Yeah, but you know, if you remember when the Vietnam War began to go wrong, you had an amazing reaction, both from inside the army. I mean, lots of soldiers just sort of voting with their feet and not fighting. But also, you had the Senate Foreign Relations Committee led by Senator Fulbright, not a very radical figure, but just questioning every single day government spokesman about what the hell was going on in Vietnam. And that began to change public opinion around. This time, there's been virtually nothing from Congress or the Senate.
It's but there's a reason for that, Tariq Ali, because the Democrats don't control any of the branches. And in fact, they're putting all their eggs in the presidential basket.
Yeah.
They're not really, I don't think that they even think that they can take back the House, and I don't think that they may even be able to hold the line in the Senate. And if the Republicans pick up a few more Senate seats and they get past the 60 filibuster-proof majority, then look out, this country will be a one-party state.
Yeah, well, it feels like that already, to tell you the truth. You know, this is why I think the resistance in Iraq has actually helped the Democrats, whether they admit it or not, to make a few criticisms of the regime. Because let's suppose nothing had happened in Iraq. There would have been no opposition in the United States.
Well, that's what I was talking to General Clark about. I mean, when is this debate going to take place?
Exactly.
It didn't take place before this stupid war, and it may have saved us a lot of grief. But, you know, I just, as I say, I just wonder whether there's any real political focus here. And,
the other big difference, of course, with the Vietnam War is that this is not a war fought by a conscripted army. It's a volunteer army. And if the figures I read are correct, 40% of the soldiers fighting are not even U.S. citizens. They are green carders who might get citizenship as a result of it and a lot of other privileges. But it's a very strange situation. You know, they're just being used as cannon fodder. And but still, I think that the casualties are going to carry on. You know, there's no way the United States can stop that. And getting the U.N. in, I mean, if the U.N., if the Europeans, that's what we're talking about, agree to send in troops, they'll suffer. So why should they send them?
Mm. Well, just in closing, Tariq Ali, you're obviously in London and there's a different European attitude to the Israeli-Palestinian situation, which just seems to be going into a ditch with the resignation of Abu Mazen. And that you are there's a much bigger Muslim population, and of course, remember Al Qaeda's the key people in 9/11 were all living in the West and very familiar with the West, and there seems to be some sort of element of this sort of second generation people stuck in limbo, not really tied to the past and not comfortable in the present. Give us a sense of what's still out there, because as far as I can tell, you know, I don't think we've made a dent in Al Qaeda. In fact, I think the way that Bush has gone about it has emboldened it. I mean, in other words, if he would have contextualized it from the very beginning, that this guy's like David Koresh from Waco, instead they've dignified him and made him a world figure and a mystical figure who, you know, who just sort of franchises terrorism.
Yeah.
Where do we stand in the last minute? I know it's a big question, but...
Well, to remember, Koresh, it was the Democrats who did that, actually. Wasn't it...
Clinton and
Janet Reno who sent in the feds?
Yes.
Anyway, I mean, the thing is, basically, that's what it does. And when I travel around the Muslim world, people get very angry with me, young people, when I criticize Osama. Many of them say, why do you criticize him? Why don't you confine your criticism to the United States? So I said, well, look, he used to work for the United States many years ago, and then they're shocked, just like people in the States are shocked when you tell them that. And I said, there is a sort of mirror fundamentalism here. There's religious fundamentalism of the Muslim sort, the Christian sort, and then there's imperial fundamentalism, and these people just play off each other. But the fact is that this big assault on Afghanistan and a failure to capture Osama bin Laden or Mullah Omar or Saddam Hussein are making these people into heroes. You know, in Iraq, Saddam was pretty much hated, as you know. But since the American occupation, lots of people, including people who really despised him, are saying, well, we were better off under him, and at least he hasn't fled the country and hidden and taken money and run. He's here fighting. His sons died fighting. So this whole business that the United States has embarked in is actually having the exactly the opposite impact. Now, if you look at the European populations, where there are millions and millions of, you know, Muslim citizens of Europe, and the kids growing up, for them, religion is very different to what it was if you grow up in a Muslim country, where, you know, there are various other things that form you, not just religion. In Europe, religion increasingly has become part of a multicultural identity. And I'm one of the critics of this. I say, look, it's dangerous. We're all in favor of multiculturalism, but don't take it to the extent where religion becomes the identity. But unfortunately, this is what is happening. So when the hits of 9/11 occurred, I know this for a fact, amongst Muslims in Canada as well as in parts of Europe, there were celebrations. And it was purely a sort of instinctive, primitive response, which if you identify solely with the religion, you can actually react like that. And I find this very, very dangerous. So people like me are constantly arguing for a different way of approaching the whole question of identity in Europe, and then the Iraq business happens. So it's just, you know, it's sort of banging one's head against a brick wall. No one's listening, and each side helps the other.
Well, I guess the one silver lining here, Tariq Ali, is that maybe the United States just aren't very good at being colonists.
This is true. They usually prefer to rule the roost by having local, what Smedley Butler used to call gangsters to run countries for them. But that sort of works for a bit, but not too long. But right. They are useless at running a country themselves. And I agree.
They're not doing a good job of running this one, neither, I must say. And I thank you for joining us. I must move on, but it's been a pleasure talking to you, Tariq Ali.
Very good.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Ian.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Tariq Ali, who's in London. He's the author of a new book that's coming out in a couple of weeks, Bush in Babylon, the Colonization of Iraq. I'm now speaking with Dr. Martin Hart Landsberg, who is the author of Korea, Division, Reunification, and U.S. Foreign Policy. He's a professor of economics and director of the Political Economy Program at Lewis and Clark College. He's also a researcher at the Institute of Social Sciences at Gwangsang National University in South Korea. And also joining us is Dr. Sunhae Sa, who is assistant professor at Scripps College, Claremont, and organizer with Nodut Dol, which I believe means stepping stones, does it not, Sunhae?
Yes, it is. Hello, it's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad that we got you both back. We had problems last week, and we're happy that you're able to come back again. And you're also, you have relatives in both in North and South Korea. Let me begin with you, Sunhae. President Carter was in Tokyo on Friday, and he's now in Beijing, and he warned that the current standoff between North Korea and the United States is the world's greatest threat. And of course, Jimmy Carter defused a crisis in 1994 that many thought would have led to war between North Korea and the United States. So, what's your sense of Carter's statement?
Well, I think what I would point to is the fact that Jimmy Carter, the former president of the United States, said that the United States has refused talks with North Korea, branded North Korean acts of evil, declared an end of no first use of atomic weapons, invaded Iraq, and has been intercepting North Korean ships at sea. The vice foreign minister of China referred to the U.S. as the main obstacle to peace and to resolving the situation. It seems to me that both activists on the ground and high-level politicians in the United States and other countries, as well as the DPRK itself, are all saying pretty much the same thing, that North Korea does not want to become a nuclear weapons power, that it wants to dismantle and is committed to dismantling, and the only thing the United States has to do is commit in a treaty or a pact not to invade and not to attack North Korea. So it seems that Jimmy Carter is just adding his voice to this global chorus calling for peace in Korea, and it's a position that the DPRK has also taken.
Dr. Martin Hart-Landsberg, do you think that given that it's the 55th anniversary of the foundation of North Korea this coming Tuesday, there's some speculation, I don't know that it's particularly solid or well-sourced, that the North Koreans may celebrate the 55th anniversary by letting off a nuclear bomb?
Well, first, it's nice to be with you, and especially important to talk about these issues right now, because I do think we, as Jimmy Carter said and the guest said, we are dangerously close to a war. No one really knows whether North Korea has nuclear weapons or not. Most of the security analysts in South Korea, China, and Russia really doubt it. But, you know, anything's possible. What I think is important to realize, though, is that the U.S. has long sought to maintain hostilities on the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. has not really been interested in trying to create a peaceful context for North and South Korea to deal with each other. The U.S. has liked having the North Korea as an enemy. It's enabled it to keep ground troops in South Korea. It's enabled it to support conservative forces in South Korea. It's enabled it to argue for missile defense treaties. And so what's happening here is the U.S. is saying the issue is North Korea's nuclear program, which is bringing a threat to the whole region. The fact is the U.S. introduced nuclear weapons in Korea in the late 50s. The U.S. used to do simulated nuclear attacks against North Korea throughout the 80s. We don't really know what North Korea has, but the problem isn't that North Korea has introduced nuclear weapons, and of course we know that Russia and China and the U.S. already have them. The problem is that the U.S. will not sit down and negotiate with North Korea for the benefit of each other's security concerns. That would be the way to handle things, but instead the focus is on North Korea, its nuclear problem, and not the continuing pressure that the U.S. is placing to keep hostilities going.
I completely agree with that. It seems that all of these alarmist statements about North Korea's threat are blowing the situation totally out of proportion. I mean, if you look at the figures, the U.S. spends something like 55 times more on its military than the DPRK spends, the North Korea spends on its military. North Korea spends less than half of what South Korea spends on its military. And most importantly of all, North Korea is not going to attack anybody. If they did, it would be suicidal, and they're not going to do that. It seems to me that if America is concerned about its own security, the only threat that could come out of North Korea is proliferation, selling weapons, not necessarily nuclear weapons, but selling weapons,
missiles and stuff like which they apparently do. Now, but isn't it also true, Sun Hee-sa, that we would ignore North Korea? They could just drop off the face of the earth if they weren't so paranoid and making these threats. Now, whether or not they plan to carry out the threats is another matter. Well, but you have to admit that they are in the business of trying to blackmail, and I think it comes from a position of desperation.
Well, I guess I would have to question the characterization of paranoid, given the fact that the United States has identified North Korea as a possible target of first strike nuclear attack. I don't know what I would do if I were targeted in that way, but I think I would be pretty alarmed myself. That said, it's true. You know, people in the United States do not know what North Korea will do. However, I think that if the United States is concerned about its own security, the thing to do is enter into dialogue, engage in a peace treaty to bring an end to the Korean War, and, you know, find a diplomatic solution to this problem. That will resolve the issue of proliferation. And again, North Korea is not going to attack anybody. It has stated it is not going to attack. And I don't think, you know, I don't know. You know, I mean, if we want to talk about blackmail, I think we have to look at the treaties. The United States and North Korea signed a framework in 1994 that if both sides had followed it, everything that each side says they want would be here right now.
Well,
by the way, on the board of directors of the company that promised to supply the reactors, sits Donald Rumsfeld.
Right.
Well, just to go back to this blackmail issue, because I think it is important. If we sort of say, what should be the starting point of relations between countries, I think normalization of relations makes sense. That's just acknowledging and exchanging ambassadors. If we said that countries shouldn't fear nuclear attack, first strike, that would seem reasonable. If we would say we wouldn't be starting by embargoing countries, that would seem reasonable. So it seems to me that when the U.S. says we'd be rewarding North Korea by normalizing relations, ending economic embargo, and acknowledging we won't strike with nuclear weapons at them first, that's not blackmail. That's just setting the terms of what should be a normal international environment. Now, beyond that, You know, how the U.S. and North Korea want to handle each other's relations is something different. But the North Koreans have been asking for a long time for a peace treaty ending the Korean War. They've been asking, and you're right, out of weakness right now because of the collapse and you know, the end of the Soviet Union, the North Koreans are desperately seeking to reconnect to the world economy. They want investment from the U.S., from Japan, from South Korea. We should be saying, well, that's good. Yet instead, what we're saying is we won't normalize relations. We won't allow investment. No one is talking about South Korea disarming. They have a huge military. They've been spending more than the North Koreans every year since 76. The U.S. military is there. Why is it that it becomes being blackmailed to talk about creating an international environment where countries can peacefully deal with each other? I think the critical thing, and it connects to your previous discussion about Iraq, is that the U.S. has found North Korea a convenient threat. When George Bush took office, the first thing he did was sabotage the attempts of South Korea and North Korea to improve relations. The first thing he did was to tell Colin Powell that he disagreed, that we, you know, the U.S. is not going to follow the framework agreement. We want a missile defense. The Axis of Evil speech, the speech writer for Bush has admitted North Korea was thrown in at the last moment. The kind of enemies that the U.S. has wanted to pursue its foreign policy means that the North Korean threat is very convenient. We have not seriously tried to create a peaceful environment on the Korean Peninsula because it's been helpful to our military, industrial complex, our missile defense desires, and the war on terrorism with disastrous results.
In fact, you could make a broader argument that all three countries of the Axis of Evil, we don't have diplomatic relations with, we don't have any intelligence on the ground, and we are willfully ignorant about them. And look where that ignorance has got us in Iraq.
Absolutely.
So let me just ask Sun Hee-sar, just in terms of following on for this willful ignorance. Apparently, the best brains that the U.S. delegation had with the knowledge of the language and the knowledge of history and contacts in North Korea just quit before these talks began in Beijing a week and a half ago. Jack Pritchett, do you know anything about that, Sun Hee-sar?
Well, I don't have any insider information on what happened, but he did quit right on the eve of those talks. He was, as you mentioned, the only person within the administration who actually was a specialist. They claimed that. They said that his resignation was in the works for months, but he also said that there was a problem with people not listening. And so I think that, you know, even from within the ranks, there are all these voices questioning the Bush policy. And I also, you know, and as we're talking about this, I think it's really important that folks in the U.S. realize that North Korea is, you know, borders China, Russia, and South Korea. Japan is very close by. The distance between Seoul, the capital of South Korea, and Pyongyang, the capital of the North, is less than half the distance between Los Angeles and San Francisco. So we're talking about an extremely densely populated region. Any kind of war that potentially could break out is going to affect not just everyone in North Korea, but people throughout the region. Sometimes some U.S. hawks are talking about taking an airstrike to bomb the nuclear facilities, but the radioactive waste could potentially reach all those countries in the region, and it would be just disastrous. So we really need to bring about a peaceful solution to this problem.
Well, and I think it's an important opportunity for people in the United States who want to change in U.S. policy to link arms with the peace movement in South Korea, which has grown increasingly strong because, quite frankly, most South Koreans do not fear North Korea attacking them. What they fear is U.S. aggression towards North Korea triggering an accident or something that will devastate everyone. They, in fact, elected their current president primarily because he spoke out in late 2002 and saying he would not support the U.S. effort to isolate and attack North Korea. People in South Korea realize that without progress in North-South relations, their ability to build a democratic country is going to be limited. Every time this war hysteria develops, conservative forces in South Korea get stronger. They repress unions, they repress students, they repress those who want to transform their own country.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here, Dr. Sun Hee-sar and Dr. Martin Hart-Landsberg. Let's stay in touch because clearly, as in the case of Iraq and in the case of North Korea, reality bites. And in this case, it's biting George Bush. And I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I must thank Lewis Vandenberg for the research and production help, and the wonderful Mark Maxwell, our board operator. You can always hear this program at ianmasters.org. That's ianmasters.org. And past programs are also archived on that website. Again, ianmasters.org. I thank you all for joining us. Bye.